"Boy," the man said, his eyes raging at Raymond, "if I were home, I'd have you in your proper place and break you good." At this, the grumbles grew into taunts, shouts, and threats. There is a moment in the stormy lives of a few blessed colored people, a moment of revelation, when the sky opens up, the clouds part, and a streak of sun cuts through, conveying some infinite wisdom from above. And this moment comes not from Christian religion, but from the sight of a colored man addressing a white one as Raymond White now did as he turned to the white man. "But you are not home." Then he looked back at the crowd, and the man following with his eyes began to understand his predicament. Rage and determination fled from him. Fear and panic closed in. The thin white man seemed to grow paler and thinner by the second. The crowd, agitated by the man's threats, now murmured to each other as to what they ought to do next. After we watched the boat shove off, Otha and I sat with Mary Bronson and her son back at the 9th Street house. Raymond had gone off to begin the business of having Mary housed and, hopefully soon, employed. It was the custom in Philadelphia to take an account of the ordeal of all who passed through the Philadelphia station. It was yet another notion that was utterly unimaginable in Virginia, where such accounts might implicate a fugitive. But Raymond believed himself in the midst of history and felt strongly that all pertaining events should be well recorded. Otha made coffee and gave Mary's son a collection of toys, cows, horses, and other farm animals rendered from wood. I took the moment to walk over to Mars's bakery, where he introduced me to his wife, Hannah. I managed to smile upon meeting her and did my best to apologize for my demeanor the day before. He handed me two loaves of warm bread and said, "Nothing to apologize for. Like I said, family." Back in the house, Mary was on the floor of the parlor playing with her son. I went to the kitchen with the bread, searched for a knife, a platter, and plates. There was a jar of preserves on the counter along with a wedge of cheese. With all of this, I fashioned a spread and placed it upon the dining room table. Otha served up the coffee for everyone and brought Mary and her son to the table. There was a gentle air of relief and even celebration in the meal. After the meal, Mary helped us clean up. Then we repaired to the living room for the interview. I watched as Mary's son took a wooden soldier in each hand, made a threatening face, and then crashed the two horses into each other with a loud "What is his name?" I asked.
"Octavius," she said. "Don't ask me why. I ain't name him. Old Master decided that, like he decided everything else."
Otha offered Mary a seat on the sofa. I went up to my room and retrieved paper and two pencils. Then I sat down at the table. Otha was to ask the questions. I would record.
"My name is Mary Bronson," she told Otha, "and I was born a slave."
"No more, though," Otha said.
"No more," Mary repeated. "And I want to thank you all for that. You got no idea what I've been through down there, what we all been through. I'd have done anything to get out from under that man. I just wasn't sure how. You know, this ain't even the first time I've been to the city, and it ain't even the first time I had the notion to run. I don't know why I ain't done it before."
"Where you from, Mary?" Otha asked.
"Hell," she said. "I am straight out of hell, Mr. Otha."
"And why you say that?" Otha asked.
"I had two other boys beside Octavius here. Two other boys and a husband. He was a cook just like me. Everybody around the house loved the work I did."
"Did you love your own work?"
"Was never my work to love. But I was different, you see. Fact of it is, I had an understanding with my old master. I did the cooking, but I wasn't the only one in the kitchen. So time to time my old master would hire me out and split whatever I made with me. Plan was to gather up enough to buy me and mine out. I would go first, so as not to have to split nothing no longer, and then I'd get my man, Fred, that was my husband's name, I'd get him so as to have another hand to work, and then we'd all together get the young'uns.
And what happened?
Old master died. Place was carved up, and one of them low whites, men you just seen, took over. Then I ain't like my work so much. He took all the money for himself, said he had no notion for any agreement with my old master, nor any banking. So I got crafty, started working slow and sloppy. But he caught on.
Mary Bronson paused here. She drew herself in, composed herself to continue. That's when the beatin' start. He set a figure for every week. Said if I ain't make that figure, he'd take it out on my hide. He threatened to sell my husband, my sons, all my boys. I worked hard as I could, Mr. Uther. He sold the men away. He spared me my youngest. She nodded to the little boy still on the floor playing with the wooden animals. But that wasn't no sympathy or concern, it was weight. He held that boy over me, so I always had something else to lose.
Why'd he bring you to the city? Otha asked.
He got family up here, she said. He was bragging to them about my work. Had me working for his sister in his sister's kitchen.
Up here?
Yes, he did. But I done showed him, have I not?
Surely you have.
Chain is a powerful thing, Mr. Otha. A powerful, powerful thing. I was thinking about all the times I come north and ain't run. I was thinking about the grip they got on me. And I knew that boy would be off to the fields in a year or so, and I knew that then they'd have him, too.
She sobbed softly into her hands. Otha went over and sat next to Mary Bronson. Then he drew her close, held her gently, patting her back. As he held her, Mary Bronson wailed, and I heard in the wailing a song for her husband, her boys, and all her lost. I had never seen an agent do what Otha was now doing, comforting her, treating her with the dignity of a free woman, not an escaped slave. He rocked her in his arms until she was settled, and then he stood and said,
"We shall have a place for you and your boy in the next few days. Raymond gone to get all that started. You and your son, welcome to stay here until it's all arranged."
Mary Bronson nodded.
"It's a good city, ma'am," said Otham, "and we are strong here. But I understand if you don't want to stay. Either way, we're going to help you how we can. As you will soon see, finding freedom is only the first part. Living free is a whole other."
There was a moment of silence. I stopped writing, thinking the interview terminated. Mary Bronson had stopped crying now. She wiped her face with Otha's handkerchief. And then she looked up and said,
"Ain't no living free unless I'm living with my boys."
She had composed herself now. I could see that her pain and fear were shifting into something else.
"I don't want to hear about your church. Don't want to hear about your city. My boys, they the only city I need. Now you done found a way to get me and Octavius out, and by God, I am thankful for it. I was raised correct. I am thankful. But my other boys, all my lost boys, that is my highest concern."
"Mrs. Bronson," said Otha, "we just ain't set up like that. That just ain't in our power."
"Then you ain't got the power of freedom," she said. "If you can't keep them from parting a mother from her son, a husband from his natural wife, then you got nothing. That boy over there is my everything. I run for him so he might know some other world. Left on my own, I would have died as I was born, a slave. That boy freed me, you see? And I owe him so much. Mostly I owe him his pappy and his brothers. If you can't stop them from breaking us up as they do, if you can't put us back together, then your freedom is thin, and your church and your city hold nothing for me."
That following Monday, I began my employment in a woodworking shop just off of the Schuylkill docks at the corner of 23rd and Locust.
The owner was an associate of Raymond White's, and a large number of those who labored there were fugitives. I worked there 3 days a week, and three for the underground. After work, I would usually walk alone through the city, taking in the incredible alchemy of sounds, odors, and sensations, all of which proceeded late into the night. But still in all, among the incredible amalgam of people, I somehow felt alone. It was Mary Bronson who'd done it, her longing, her hunger for a freedom that extended to all of her blood. For what did it mean to be free in a city such as this, when those you hold to most are still tasked? What was I without Sophia, without my mother, without Thina? Thina. "Boy like you should be more careful with his words," she said. "Never know when they, the last ones he might put upon a person. And I should have been. I knew that even then. But I was now aging faster than my years, so that Thina's words redounded with the lamenting of a man much older than my 20 years. My treatment of her was the worst thing I'd done in my short life. I saw now that I had been little more than a boy lusting after a dream. And now the dream was gone, like Mary Bronson's boys were gone, carried off into the deep, far from any means the underground might muster to recover it. One Friday morning, as I was leaving for work, Otha approached me and said, "A man can't be too long without family." I stared back and said nothing. He smiled. "Still, it might be nice to be with some folks who care, Hiram. Supper? Tonight? At my mama's? What do you say? Whole family'll be there. We good folks, I tell you, and would very much welcome you as our own." "All right, Otha," I said. "Lovely. Just lovely," he said. Then he tendered directions and said, "See you tonight." The White family home was across the Delaware River. I caught the ferry that evening, then walked along a cobbled road until it turned to clay and then to dust. The heat of the city, the air damp and thick, faded behind me, and a refreshing breeze swirled up the road. It was good to be out. It was my first time in anything like the country since my arrival, and now I realized everything that I missed about my old southern home. The wind in the fields, the sun pushing through the trees, the drawn-out afternoons. Everything happened at once in Philadelphia, all of life one ridiculous crush of feeling. The parents of Raymond and Otha lived in a large house with a porch wrapping around and a pond out front. I stood for some time on that porch, staring at the front door. Inside, I could hear children and mothers, fathers and brothers, their words and laughter mixing into a happiness that took me back to Holiday down at the street. Even before I stepped inside the house, all their accumulated affection radiated out. I had felt something like it before. Under the Goose, where I was in reunion with a mother whom I could not remember. Where I saw my cousins and Honas and young P. And no sooner did I recall this feeling than it all came upon me again. The summer breeze grew chill, I shivered, and everything before me went blue. The door to the still home expanded into many doors all in a row, and these doors pulled away from each other like bellows. I felt myself falling away. A door opened. I looked in. I saw my mother's hand reaching out from the smoke. She walked toward me, her hand reaching for mine, and when she grabbed it, the blue faded and the yellow heat of that summer afternoon returned. And in the doorway I saw a woman, who was not my mother, but about the age she would have been. And just behind her I saw Otha, who, seeing me, stopped, waved, and smiled. "Hiram?" the woman asked. And before I could respond, she said, "That must be you. You look like you've seen the devil himself." She gripped my hand tight and then looked into my eyes. "Uh-huh. Hunger'll do that to a man. What Raymond and Otha got you eating down there? Why, don't just stand there. Come on in." I followed for a couple of steps until the woman stopped and said, "Viola White, I'm Raymond and Otha's mother. But you just call me Aunt Viola, because that is who I am to you. Any man working with Otha and Raymond is family to me." I followed Viola White, Aunt Viola would take some time with me, into the front parlor and found a crush of cousins and aunts. Raymond stood at the mantel talking with an older man. Mars, the proprietor of the bakery, rushed over and pulled me into a big scrum of family, rendering introductions and discoursing on the effects of that gingerbread.
"The boy try make like he cool, like he wasn't caught," Mars told his wife, Hannah. "But soon as he stick his face in the paper, I knew I had him."
Hannah laughed, and I, surprising myself, laughed too. Something was happening here. Walls were falling down, walls I had erected down on the street. My silence, my watching, was a wall. There was love even on the street, I tell you, some of the deepest and hardest I'd ever seen. But the street was brutal and erratic. Passions transfigured into outrages and violence, even among us. But the demeanor that served me at Lockless seemed cruel and unnecessary among the whites, so I found myself awkwardly and haltingly smiling, laughing, and above all, talking. After supper, we took coffee and tea in the back salon. There was a piano there, and one of the younger girls seated herself and began to play. What I remember more than any virtuosity was the gleaming pride in all the eyes of the white family at the talents of this child. And I remembered how I had talents, too, as a child, but that my own father wished them to be in Little May. I was an amusement, a source of laughter. Watching that little girl encouraged in her pursuits, rewarded in whatever genius she had, and we all had some, I saw all that had been taken from me, and all that was so regularly taken from the millions of colored children bred to the task. But more than this, I saw for the first time colored people in that true freedom that Mary Bronson longed for, that I hungered for walking through the city, that I had glimpsed under the goose. I had noticed throughout conversation the names Lydia and Lambert, and I knew from how they were spoken that these two were family still held down by the task. After the young girl's recital, I found Otha seated on the large porch, looking out past the road and into the lush green woods in the light of summer's twilight. I took a seat and said, "I want to thank you for having me here, Otha. It means a lot." Otha looked to me and smiled.
"It's nothing, Hiram. I'm glad you came. The work can be such a weight."
"Your mother," I said, looking back inside. "I gather she knows?"
"They all do. The baby's only a little, of course, but how could they not know? They the reason we in the work to begin with."
"You've got a beautiful family," I said. At that he went quiet for a moment, and his gaze returned to those woods. "Otha," I asked, "Lambert and Lydia?"
"Lambert was my brother," said Otha,
"and Lydia is my wife.
Lambert died while I was still down, and Lydia is still there, though I have not seen her in some years."
"Children?"
"Yep. Two girls, one boy."
"You?" I paused for a moment. "No, just me."
"Huh. Don't know what I'd do without my young ones. Don't know who I'd be. This whole thing, this underground, starts with my babies."
Otha stood and looked through the door inside. We could hear the gentle clanging of dishes, rumbling and somber talk broken by the occasional giggling of children. Then he walked to the side of the porch and seated himself there against the wooden railing.
"I'm not like them. Wasn't raised up here," he said. "My daddy is old and stooped now, but he was something in his day, born to the task. But in his 21st year, he walked up to his old master and told him straight, 'I'm grown now, and I shall sooner die as have the yoke.' And the old master thought on it for a day, and when he next saw my pappy, he had a rifle in one hand and pappy's papers in the other. And he told my pappy, just as straight as my pappy had told him, 'Freedom is a yoke, boy. You'll soon see.' Then he handed pappy the papers and said, 'Now get off my land, for the next time you and I meet, only one of us shall walk away.'" Otha laughed at that. But there was this girl, Viola, Mama, who was tasking there too.
There was two of us by then, myself and my brother Lambert. Daddy had it figured that he would get up north, get some work, and then buy us our freedom. He started out at the docks, saving for the day he could get us all out. But Mama had her own notions. She ran with me and Lambert, took the underground as it was back then, shocked the life out of Daddy when she showed herself down at the city docks. They married proper, and two more was born, Raymond and Patsy. That's Patsy's daughter who was at the piano. Girl can sing like a bird. The old master let my daddy walk, but don't ask me why. Who can figure white folks? But for my mother, a girl, to take mastery of her life as she did, well, it was too much. Maybe it was how she did it, just up and leaving, or maybe it was us. Mama was the goose, but we was the golden eggs. That man sent the hounds up to the city. They bagged me, my brother Lambert, my mama, Raymond, and Patsy, the whole family save my daddy. We was carried back. When we got there, Mama made it out as though the escape was all Daddy's idea. Told the old master she never wanted no part in running away. Flattered him into believing he was good white folks. And I guess the old master believed her. Maybe he needed to believe her, needed to think that he was doing some kind of good, dividing a family and holding them down. Anyway, wasn't long after that, Mama ran again. Went different this time, though. She woke me up in the dead of night. I must have been about 6, Lambert about 8, but I can still see it, like it's all right in front of me. The memory is sharp as an axe. She was at our bedside when she told us. Baby, I got to go. I got to go for Raymond, and I got to go for Patsy. They're going to die down here. I am so sorry, baby, but I got to go. I know why she done it now. I knew why she done it even back then. But it burnt in me, a low, heavy hatred. Can you imagine hating your own mother, Hiram? After that, the old master sold us south. 2 lost boys sent down into the deep. They did it to punish my mama, to show her that whatever plan she had of coming back for me and Lambert was done. I had a whole other life down there. I met a girl, my Lydia, and we made a family. I tasked hard. I was a man well regarded in slavery, which is to say I was never regarded as a man at all. Lambert knew, maybe because he was older. He knew all that was taken from us. And the hate in him was so strong it just ate him. So Lambert died down there, far from home, far from the mother that birthed him and the father that reared him. And here Otha caught up. I could not see his face, but I heard the halting in his voice, and I felt a halo of agony burning all around him. There are so many holes in me, so many pieces cut away. All those lost years, my mother, my father, Raymond and Patsy, my wife and kids, all my losses. Well, I got out. My master needed the money more than he needed to hold me, and through the kindness of others, I got out. I came up to this city searching for my family, for I was left with rumors of where we had been. And soon I heard from the coloreds that this man Raymond White was a good one to know, should you be searching for family. I sought him out. "Y'all recognize each other?" I asked. Not even a little bit. And I had no surname. He sat with me, just like we sat with Mary Bronson a few weeks back, and I gave him my whole story. Later, Raymond told me that he trembled with every detail. But you know Raymond. He is a rock. So I'm sitting there telling him all that I know, and I'm wondering how he's taking it, because the whole time he just real quiet. Then he tell me come see him again tomorrow, same time. Next day I come back, and there she was, Hiram. I knew her right away. I didn't even need to search myself or think no time on it. It was my mama. And then Mama tell me that this man, this rock, was my brother. It's the only time I seen tears in Raymond's eyes. When we was young, Lambert and me had all kinds of schemes for seeing our way out. We knew our people were somewhere free. But when all of our plans fell to pieces, despair fell over us like a shadow. You see, we was different than men such as you, Hiram. We had known since the day our mother vanished that we were born to the title of freedom. And if freedom was my mama's right and freedom was my daddy's right too, then somehow it must be ours. I think we all got it fixed that way, I said. For some, it's just buried far deep. But it was never buried for us. Lambert remembered everything from that last night. He remembered Mama's caress upon his forehead, the last stroke of her hand. When Lambert died, Hiram, I knew that I could not. I knew that I must somehow live and then get back out. And I knew that any anger in that venture was a waste. I think back to my Mama's words the night she left. I think about them all the time in this work, in my time on the underground. I gotta go for Raymond, and I gotta go for Patsy, she said. I am so sorry, baby, but I got to go. And I, being young and loving my mama, I said, Mama, why can't we go with you? And my mama, she said, 'cause I can only carry so many, and them only so far.
Chapter 17. The conductions were more frequent now. The world would suddenly and randomly fall away, and moments later, I would return dumped into back alleys, basements, open fields, stock rooms. Every conduction seemed activated by a memory, some whole, some mere shards, like a vision of a woman who snuck me ginger snaps. But with the glue of tales swapped down in the street, I assembled a rough picture. The woman who'd slipped me ginger snaps was my Aunt Emma. I remembered the stories of her prowess in the Lockless kitchen. And I also thought it was no mistake that this Aunt Emma was the same aunt who would water dance out in the woods with her sister, my mother. I began to feel that something was trying to reveal itself to me, that some part of my mind long ago locked away was now seeking its liberation. Perhaps I should have greeted the unraveling of a mystery and new knowledge with relief. But conduction felt like the breaking and resetting of a bone. Each bout left me fatigued, and with a somehow deeper sense of loss than the one I'd carried into it, so that I was in a constant low thrum of agony, a melancholy so deep it would take every ounce of my strength to rise out of bed the next morning. For days after each conduction, I would still be working my way through the most sullen of moods. This no longer felt like freedom. Not anymore. And so one day I walked out of the 9th Street office, set upon the intention to leave Philadelphia and the underground, leave the triggers for these memories that threw me into depression. I did not meditate on this decision. I did not gather any effects. I simply walked out the door with no view of ever coming back. I reasoned that my initial exit would alarm no one, since it was known that I enjoyed walking through the city. But then I would just keep walking. I turned away from the office and made my way over toward the Schuylkill docks. Of all the people I saw in the city, the sailors seemed the most free, tied to nothing save each other, bound by boyish jabs and indecent mockery that always elicited a host of laughter. Sometimes they fought. But whatever their quarrels, these men seemed a brotherhood to me. Even in their freedom, they still somehow reminded me of home. Maybe it was their hard black faces, their rough hands, bent fingers, bruised and worn down nails. Maybe it was how they sang, because they sang as the Tasked did. I stood at the dock watching them work, hoping one might call out to me, perhaps asking for a hand, and when no one did, I left, and that whole day I just wandered. I crossed the river, past the cemetery and some railroad tracks, and stopped before an almshouse to watch the indigent of the city gather. I walked more until I stood before Cobb's Creek and a forest at the southwesterly recesses of the city. By now, it was late. I had no plan, and it was getting dark. I really had no way out. no way to escape the underground nor the binds of memory. So I turned around, and these were the thoughts that clouded me on my way back to 9th Street, back to my fate, the notions that kept me from watching as I had been trained to do. Suddenly, I was face to face with a white man who seemed to materialize out of the night itself. He asked me something, but I could not hear. I leaned closer, asking him to repeat himself, and then I felt a sharp blow fall across the back of my head. There was a bright flash, another blow, and then nothing. When I awoke, I was, once again, chained, blinded, and gagged. I was in the back of a drawn cart and could feel ground moving beneath me. I cleared my head and knew exactly what had befallen me, for I had heard all the stories. It was the man-catchers, Ryland's hounds of the north, who had gotten me. They were known to simply grab colored people off the street and ship them south for a price, with no regard to their status as free or in flight from the task. I could hear them laughing with each other, doubtlessly counting up their haul. I was not alone in the cart. Someone near me was weeping quietly, a girl. But I was silent. I had wanted out of the underground, and now I had it. There was some small part of me that felt relief, for I was at least returning to the task I knew. We rode for several hours across the backcountry roads. Ryland, I reasoned, would like to avoid towns, toll roads, and ferries, for as sure as we feared Ryland, Ryland feared the vigilance committees, allies of the underground, which stood watch for man-catchers who sought to drag freedmen down. We stopped to make camp, and I felt rough hands around my arms. I was pulled along for a moment and then tossed to the ground.
"Take care, deacons," I heard one of them say. "Damage that boy, and I'll damage you."
This man, Deacons, propped me up against a tree. I could move my fingers, but nothing else. I was listening to their voices, attempting to calculate their number, when I saw a brightness through my blindfold, a campfire. The men gathered around and traded their small talk. I now counted 4 voices, and from their words and general commotion, it became clear that they were eating their last meal. I never heard him approach, and doubtless neither did Ryland. There was a crack of a pistol shot, twice, a scream, a struggle, and then 2 more cracks, then a bit of whining like a child's, but not the child I'd heard in the wagon. Another crack, and then nothing for a moment. And then I heard someone rummaging for something, and again I felt hands upon me, the click of a lock, and the chains loosened. With a furor that shocked me, I pushed the hands away as well as their possessor and pulled off my blindfold and gag. And by the firelight, I saw him, Mr. Fields, Makaja Bland, regarding me with the most stolid and unmoved face. I stood and leaned against the tree to settle myself. There were 2 others, bound and manacled, as I was. Bland worked quickly, moving among them. I looked away and saw 4 bodies on the ground. How do I explain what happened in that moment? The blinding, unconscious rage I felt? It was as if I had been lifted out of myself to behold the scene, and what I saw was me kicking one of the corpses with all the power I could muster. Bland came over to stop me. I pushed him away again and kicked the dead man, Deacons, perhaps, even more. Bland did not try to stop me this time. In that moment, all the rage of everything from my mother to Maynard to Sophia to Thina to Corrine, all the lies, all the losses, all that they had done to me in the jail parlor, all the violation, all my impotence for the little boy in my cell, for the old man who loved the wife of his son, for the days they chased me into the woods, all of it came up there and vented itself on a dead man. Finally tired, I doubled over on my knees. The fire was now burning low, but I could see Bland standing there with a girl and a man, and the man stood in front of the girl to shield her from my anger, and it occurred to me then that the man was the girl's father.
"Are you finished?" Makaja Bland asked.
"No," I said. "Not ever." We are all divided against ourselves. Sometimes part of us begins to speak for reasons we don't even understand until years later. The voice that took me away from the underground was familiar and old in me. This was the voice that conspired to come up off the street.
This was the voice that consigned my mother to the down there. It was the voice that had spoken to Thina and so callously left her behind. It was the voice of freedom, a cold Virginia freedom, freedom for me and those I chose. But now, a new voice was rising, one enriched by the warmth of the house of Viola White, and the ghost of my Aunt Emma, who from somewhere deep within me admonished me, "Don't forget, family." We walked through the woods until we reached a town where Bland had left his horses, carriage, and a cart. And I was aware now of the blow I'd taken earlier. As my head was pounding steadily, seemingly in rhythm with every step we took, I sat in the cart with the girl and her father. Morning was just beginning to break over the horizon in a fan of orange and blue. We had gone a few miles when we stopped. I turned and saw Bland talking to a small woman standing in the road, her whole body wrapped and covered in a shawl. Then she turned and began walking to the back of the cart. When she was close enough, she put a hand on my cheek, and then my forehead, and then the back of my head, which was sore to the touch. I could now see that she was, judging by her countenance, only slightly older than me, and yet in her approach, in her confidence and command, I sensed someone much senior.
"Got him, did you?"
she said, calling back to Bland, even as her hand was still on my face. "Yes," Bland said. "They had not even made it that far out, and the fools decided to stop and have a banquet." She turned to Bland and said,
"Glad they did."
Then she turned back to me and said in a soft voice,
"But you, boy, what were you doing? And what kind of agent let them hounds get under him like that? Almost carried you off."
I said nothing but felt my face burn. She laughed and pulled back her hand.
"All right," she said to Bland. "Y'all, get gone."
The cart began to creak as the horses moved. The woman waved to us and then walked off into the woods to our rear. I could feel some excitement in the cart now. The man and the girl started chattering with each other. When I didn't join in, the man leaned over to say,
"Don't you know who that was?"
"Not particularly," I said.
"Moses," he said.
He waited for a moment as if to recover from the effect that speaking the fact of things had on him.
"My God," and he paused again, "that was Moses."
There seemed to be as many names for her as legends. The General, the Knight, the Vanisher, Moses of the Shore who summoned the fog and parted the river. This was the one of whom Corrine and Hawkins had spoken, the living master of conduction. I did not register all of this at that moment. Too much had happened, and I was mostly in shock at all that had befallen me. An hour later, the girl was asleep in her father's lap. Bland pulled over the cart and called for me to join him in the front. We rode for another few minutes in silence. I broke it with a question.
"How did you find me?"
He snorted and laughed.
"We are all watched, Hiram."
"If you were watching," I said, "why you ain't stopped them before they socked me and dragged me out of the city?" Bland shook his head.
"The men, the ones who grabbed you, they've operated in Philadelphia for some time now. They prey off the free coloreds. Children are especially prized. We can't really stop them. But sometimes we get a chance to send a message as to just how dangerous the man-catching business can truly be."
"So you planned it all?" I asked.
"No, but you asked why we didn't stop them. And this is why. To send a message, a warning. To make their cohort understand the perils of their trade. We could not send such a message in the confines of the city, but out here in the open country, with no one to tell..."
"Murder?" I said.
"Murder? Do you know what they were going to do to you?"
"Yeah, I do know," I said. And at that moment I was back at that terrible night, chained to the fence with Sophia at my side, and I was recalling how badly I wanted to give in to it all, to die right there, and how she held me up and spoke to me without speaking, how strong she was when I needed her most, and how foolish I had been when she needed me. And now she was gone, and they, Ryland, the hounds, had done God knows what with her. I said, "You only got half the story about me. You know about the girl, Sophia, the one I ran with, but you don't really know the feeling I had for her and how much it aches me that they have her now while I'm up here breathing the free air. All I can tell you is she was better than me. Fact is, sometimes I think you got the wrong one for an agent. Should have been her." I began to weep, softly and quietly, but enough that I had to stop and collect myself. "She saw so much in me," I said. "But I fell, and Sophia fell with me. And here I am, up here in the north, and she is... I don't even know where she is. What I know is she deserved better than me. She deserved more than a man who would lead her right into the jaws of Ryland." And at this there was no control. I was weeping openly. It was all out there now. I had led a woman I loved right into the maw. And the weight that this put upon me was now open and known. Bland made no effort to conciliate. He kept his eyes on the road, and when I had stopped weeping, he spoke. "You know that feeling you had for this woman, Sophia?" he asked. "You know how it rips you to pieces, wondering what became of her? You know all the moments you've lost wondering how you might have done things different? And you know all the nights you've sat up wondering if she were even alive? Hiram, that is the feeling that marks an entire nation held down. A whole country looking up, wondering for their fathers and sons, for their mothers and daughters, cousins, nephews, friends, lovers. You say, 'I murdered those men back there.' But I say to you that I saved the lives of so many unknowable others. Those who would murder you, strip you away from all your family and your friends, and remember nothing of it. They cannot live, not without some fear, some specter. And if murder is what you must name it, then I gladly accept the claim." We rode in silence for a moment. "Thank you," I said. That should have been the first thing I said. "Thank you." "No need to thank me, Hiram. This work, this war, it gives my own life meaning. I don't know what I'd be without it. And I must say that I think if you gave it a chance, you might well find meaning." Bland was still talking, but the headache overpowered everything, and soon, to my great relief, the world faded away, and I slipped out of consciousness. Late that next day, I awoke with a dull ache all over my body. I dressed, walked downstairs, and found Raymond, Otha, and Bland all in conference. They summoned me over, and I sat down before them. Scanning their faces, I had the sense that they were ashamed of something almost, my foolishness at being captured, perhaps. And I thought then that they had been called to do something awful yet necessary. "Hiram," Raymond said, "Bland is an old friend to me. I trust him as much as my own family, and, to be truthful with you, more than certain members of that family. He is not, as you well know, an exclusive agent of this station. He has his acquaintances across the underground, and in his dealings with those acquaintances has, on occasion, taken up projects that would not have met my approval. I understand that you were among those projects." I began to feel a shift in the temperature of things. "I know well the methods and the reputation of Corrine Quinn. They are not my methods, Hiram, no matter their aim." Raymond shook his head now and looked to the ground. "This ritual, burial, the hunting, the chasing, it is all abhorrent to me. In that spirit, I am compelled to say that you are owed an apology. I feel that what was done to you, no matter the aims, was wrong." "It was not you who did it," I said.
Yes, but it is my cause. It is my army, and while I cannot balance Corrine's accounts, I can tend to my own, and it was wrong, not just on her behalf, but to our cause. And here Raymond paused a moment before looking back at me. No matter what power may beat in your breast. I understand, I said. It is nothing. I understand. Now Raymond took in a deep breath. No, Hiram, he said. I do not think you truly do. I know more than you give me credit for, Hiram, Bland said. What do you mean, I asked. I mean, I knew it all. I knew about Sophia, all about your feelings. It is my business to know. And that is why I know not just how you felt then, nor just how you feel now. I also know exactly where Sophia is being held. What? I said. My head throbbed with almost the same force it had throbbed last night. We had to know, Bland said. What kind of agents would we be if we didn't know exactly who you ran with and what became of them? I asked Corrine, I said. She said it was out of her power. I know, Hiram, I know. It was wrong. I can't defend it. I can only tell you what you must already know, that when you are operating as Corrine Quinn does, on the other side of the line, the math is different. It has to be. You were part of that math. I screened out the headache and said, Where? Your father's place, Lochless. Corrine prevailed on him to take Sophia back. But you didn't get her out? All the power held by your underground and you... Virginia has its rules. We took what we could from them. We could not take it all. And so that's it? I said. You're going to leave her to it? No, Otha said. We don't never leave nobody to it, ever. They have their rules, and by God, we got ours. Hiram, Raymond said. We don't mean to just offer you an apology. It is not just words we bring, but action to match them. You see, we don't just know where Sophia is, Bland said. We know precisely how to bring her out. Chapter 18. For those next few days walking the streets of Philadelphia or at work with chisel and lathe, at work forging the letters and passes, I thought of little else but Sophia. I thought of her water dancing by the fire. I saw us under the gazebo training the jar of ale. I remembered her long fingers brushing against the dusty furniture in the workshop. I thought of us down by the gulch, and I very badly wished I had embraced her there. And I thought of all the possibilities of a life up here, of a family of our own, of gingerbread memories and daughters who sang after dinner and long walks by the schoolkill. And I wanted badly to show this world to her, wondered what she would make of it all, the trains, the crush of people, the omnibus, all of which were, day by day, more and more familiar. 2 weeks after I was taken by the man-catchers, I was summoned out to Raymond's home across the river. He met me on the porch and told me he was alone, his wife and children were in the city, and I gathered, from the look on his face, that this was by design. There were always so many secrets. We went into the home and climbed up to the second level, where he reached up and grasped a metal ring attached to a hinge in its wooden housing in the ceiling, and pulled gently until the ceiling opened up and a ladder slid down. We then climbed up the ladder into the rafters of the home. Raymond walked to a corner where I saw several small wooden crates. He selected two. We carried them back down out of the rafters, closed up the ceiling again, and took them down to the drawing room. Raymond opened the crates and said, Have a look, Hiram. Reaching in, I found an assortment of paper, correspondences with fugitives, filled with kind words, familial reports, and grave intelligence on the movements of Ryland's hounds, the plots and intrigues of the slave power, and most often requests for the liberation of relatives. I saw that he marked those that he had acknowledged and those he hoped to. There was great value in these papers, and he had crates of them. Much to be learned about the actions of our enemies,
but should our enemies ever acquire them, much to be learned of our own. In the wrong hands, countless agents would be exposed. The stories here are beyond anything anyone could ever believe, even those of us who are actually party to them, Raymond said. I was still filing through them, amazed at the array. It seemed that there was a testimony from nearly everyone who'd ever run from the task and been rescued by the Philadelphia station. It occurred to me that my own interview with Mary Bronson likely was contained there. It is good to remember why we do what we do. I have worked with agents of all persuasion, and I cannot say that they are moved by the purest of motives. Possible that none of us is pure, I said. Possible we all got our reasons for doing what we do. Indeed, Raymond said. Can I say that without the connection of my family, I would be here right now, involved as I am? Of course not. And family is what we promised you, is it not? Your beloved Sophia, who ran with you in a manner not so different from all those stories contained in my files. Indeed, not so different from my very own parents. Somewhat different, I said. We never got to a point of seeing things clear. We were very young. It's odd to say it as such, I know. Ain't even been a year since I was captured. But there was something there. Something we were nursing that I do believe would have bloomed into family. But maybe not. Maybe I imagined it all. Well, he said, at the very least you are owed a chance to find out. I believe so. It is not the simplest of matters, this business with Sophia. But you have been toyed with too much, Hiram, and so I will make the statement concerning you directly, and then give you the rest of it after. I took a deep breath preparing myself. We have yet to make contact with her. It is a delicate matter, as you can imagine, one that will require some time. But Bland has devised a plan for her conduction. Indeed, he has volunteered to handle this thing personally. But there is a complication here, not with Sophia, but with us. You have caught us at a particular time, as we are occupied with another operation, he said. Otha has spoken to you of his wife? Lydia, I asked. Yes, Lydia, and not just Lydia, but their children, my nieces and nephews. It has long been our plan to see them out. Otha appeared to us as though out of a dream. We had thought him lost. But through fortune and the grace of God, he returned to us. And as happy as he has been to be back among us, and as happy as we have been to have him, we are not whole. Lydia is in Alabama. Her owner has defied all our entreaties to pay for her freedom. And worse, we believe those entreaties have only raised his suspicions and made him watchful. Lydia and the children are truly in the coffin, Hiram. And with each day there, the coffin closes a little more. I understand, I said. Everyone, but everyone in their time. Yes, Raymond said. Everyone in their time. But there is more still. This operation is not just personal, but costly. We need someone to assist Bland, someone to ensure he can leave for Alabama at the appropriate time. Of course, it's why I'm here. No, this is personal. This is not the underground as you understand it. And this is certainly not Corrine. There are those who would object to this, and so I need you to understand this is of your own free will. Indeed, if you cannot help us in this, we will still proceed with the rescue of your family. As I've said, it is my feeling that you have endured more than what was just. We do this for you as a way of bringing matters into balance, no matter Corrine's feelings on things. Yeah. I figured, I said. This ain't really Corrine's sort of deal. She is a good woman, I think, and they are no doubt in a good fight, but what I have seen up here, what I have seen of your mama, your cousins, your uncles, ain't just the fight. I have seen the future. I have seen what we are fighting for. I am thankful for Corrine. I am thankful for the fight. but I am most thankful to have seen all that is coming. And now here, I did something very curious. I smiled. And it was an open and generous smile, one that rose up out of a feeling with which I was so rarely acquainted. Joy. I was joyous at the thought of what was coming. I was joyous at the thought of my role in this. "So I am in, Raymond," I said. "Whatever that means, I am in."
"Excellent," Raymond smiled and said. "And you are welcome to remain here as long as you like with these correspondences. As you saw, there are more upstairs. My wife will return soon, and the children, in the afternoon, but don't let that stop you. Explore as you need. May we never forget why we do this, Hiram." I spent the rest of the day lost in Raymond's files, as thrilling as any Ivanhoe or Rob Roy. In the evening, I joined the family for dinner and accepted an invitation to stay the night and thus continued my reading by lantern light. I left the next morning after a small breakfast. I felt myself unbalanced by all that I had so quickly consumed, for it was only now, through those files, that I came to understand the great span of the Underground's operations and the lengths to which its clients had gone to escape the task. There in my hands, in those files, legends came alive. The resurrection of Box Brown, the saga of Ellen Craft, the flight of Jarm Logue. These stories were incredible, and taken together they gave me some sense of why Raymond and Otha would dare such a thing as a liberation up out of the Alabama coffin. They had dared so much already. In Virginia, what mattered was immediate and invisible. And while Raymond would not wish these files to be exposed to the world, not just then, the safety of a free state made him bold. Freedom was what mattered to him. Freedom was his gospel and his bread. Leafing through the pages, I felt the stories come alive before me. I saw them as though I was right there, so that on the walk to the ferry, on the ferry itself, and then all the way to Philadelphia Station, legions of colored people, panoramas of their great escapes, overlay the geography so that I saw them all before me, saw them coming up from Richmond and Williamsburg, from Petersburg and Hagerstown, from Long Green and Darby, from Norfolk and Elm, and I saw them fly from Quindaro to take haven in Granville, then bed down in Sandusky and rejoice just west of Bird in Hand, not so far from Millersville, a small pass to Cedars. And I saw them fleeing with Irish girls, absconding with mementos of lost children, running with salt pork and crackers, running with biscuits, flying with cuts of beef, inhaling the last of the master's terrapin soup, taking drags of his Jamaican rum, and then out into winter, thoughtless and shoeless, but freedom-bound. Black maids running with dreams of holy union, running with double-barreled pistol and dirk, so that when confronted by hounds they pulled out yelling, "Shoot! Shoot!" They fled with young children dosed into slumber, with old men who shuffled out into the frost, who died exposed in the wood, and with these words on their lips, "Man made us slave, but God willed us free." And in all these words, and in each of these stories, I saw as much magic as anything I'd seen in The Goose, souls conducted as surely as I was out from its depths. And I saw them coming up on railroads, barges, river runner, skiff, and bribery coach. Coming up on horseback over hard snow and March-melting ice. They were fitted in ladies' dress, and came up in gentry clothes, and came up in dental bandage, and came up in sling, and came up in rags, not worthy the laundry ladies watching, but came up. They bribed low whites and stole horses. Crossed the Potomac in wind, storm, and darkness. Came up as I had, driven by the remembrance of mothers or wives sold south for the high crime of standing contrary before lust. They came up devoured by frost. They came up with tales of hard drinkers and overseers who took glee in applying the lash. They came up stowed like coffee in boats, braving turpentine, scarred and singed by saltwater anointing, guilt-racked for finding themselves so broken that they should bow before their own flogging, for having held their brothers down under the master's lash. In the stories that day, I saw them running out into the forest, clutching a Brussels carpet bag, yelling,
I shall never be taken. I saw them boarding ferries, singing low and only to themselves.
God made them birds and the greenwood tree, and all has got their mate but soul-sick me.
I saw them that day at the Philadelphia docks praying, Hide the outcast, betray not him that wandereth. I saw them wandering on Bainbridge and crying for all their dead, those who had taken ship for the final harbor from whence none shall return. All of them came to me, from the papers, from the memories, all of them drawn up from pandemonium, up from slavery, up out of the jaw of the abomination, up out from under the juggernaut's wheels, singing before the sorcery of this underground. The following evening, I went to Makaja Bland. I was still shaken from being stolen off the streets of the city. I analyzed everyone from afar. When people walked close behind, I stopped to let them pass. Low whites of a particular style and dress became particularly suspicious to me, as hounds so often drew allies from their ranks. And there were low whites all over